So tonight I want to introduce you to, if you're not already familiar with, the concept of going forth. And I'll do that by sharing my experience of going forth, and I especially want to share with you some of the great resources that I've discovered during my journey or sabbatical of this year. When I retired and moved to Asheville in 2014, I had a vision, but not necessarily a plan. I knew I wanted to live differently, more wholesome, and more skillfully. I wanted to start a business with sound massage and Tibetan bowls, but not a bread and butter business, more of a business in service. So I spent my first few months engaged in volunteer services like Brother Wolf, and for the first time, it felt like in my life, I could just wake up and say, what do I want to do today? And I didn't have to answer to anyone. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to go anywhere. And then in just a few short months, I found AIM. I fell in love when I came to AIM. The teachings, the gatherings, the sense of community. It was so easy to connect with others because even though we have different experiences, we all kind of speak the same language. Before I came to AIM and I told people I was going to go sit in silence for 10 days, they kind of looked at me like, why? And now, when I tell someone that I'm going to go sit in silence for 10 days, they go, ooh, maybe I can go with you. Or, who are you going to sit with? It's like we get it. We speak the same language and we understand. We take the five precepts and we study the four noble truths and the eightfold path. I felt extremely blessed when Rania asked me to participate in the facilitator training program. She guided us through a deeper level of understanding of the Dhamma and introduced us to some of the resources she had encountered during her ongoing training. 2 years later, when the training program came to a close, I felt ready for something more, an even deeper level of experience and study. But I had made a commitment to my old dog, Paz, who just turned 13, that I wouldn't go on long retreats as long as he's still with me. I've shared before, some of you know the story that in 2004 I went into the Peace Corps. I gave away, sold most of my belongings. A dear friend agreed to take care of my cat while I was gone, till I returned. So there was a lot of loss on many levels. And one day while I was in Botswana, I was talking to a friend in the States about some challenges I was having. Challenges I had experienced here in the States, but this time I had no safety net of known cultural norms or friends, teachers, or a therapist who really understood the American psyche and my experience of being in Botswana. I explained to her how many of my unhealthy patterns were showing up and told her that I felt like I was on retreat. I couldn't escape myself, and I only had myself and my practice to rely on. So last year I found myself thinking a lot about that experience, and as the training program came to an end, I considered how I might go forward. At some point it occurred to me that it was a very unique situation. I'm turning 60 this year, which is a great time to reflect on one's life. I'm retired, and if I live within my means, within my pension, you know, I'm okay. I don't have to go to work right now. I'm only responsible for my boys, Paz and Buddha Baby. And at the time, I was only responsible to my volunteer engagements. So what a perfect time to go on sabbatical, to take an entire year to do the kind of work that I was doing in Botswana, but to do it where I have resources, the Sangha, the friends, the internet, the teachers, the retreats. It's all here to support me. I really wasn't sure what my sabbatical was going to look like, and so I just started disengaging. I disengaged from my dream circle and my Sangha circle. I resigned from the retreat coordinator position and my hospice service. And I told Rania that I wanted to reduce my facilitating and training schedule. I wanted as few distractions as possible because I wanted firsthand experience without a lot of influence from others. I began the year with a week-long retreat, and I'm, of course, halfway through, having just passed the summer solstice. I would love to tell you all that I've lost 40 pounds, I meditate 4 or 5 hours a day, and I'm enlightened. However, that's not the case. As a teenager, I expected the worst and hoped for the best. And after years of therapy and wisdom gained through life experience and maybe a healthy dose of New Age law of attraction, I learned to just be with the flow of life, to mindfully set my intention and surrender to the impermanence of life. To have an idea of what I want, but not an attachment to how it has to happen or what it has to look like. I've never interpreted the Buddha's teachings as all beings must suffer. The First Noble Truth is simply all beings suffer. And I really feel fortunate to have suffered deeply in my early life so I could test the remaining noble truths, determine on my own if they're true. Do I indeed create my own suffering? And I'm ever so grateful to the Buddha for laying out the Eightfold Path and showing me that, yeah, there is a way. So I share that to introduce a couple of resources that came into my life through what I think is sheer synchronicity. With pure intention, I put out into the world my desire for a year of contemplation and reflection. And what hit my inbox? Well, I got an email from our Sangha sister, Trish, who suggested I read a book, Journal of Solitude, by Mae Sarton. And I also got an email from Tricycle offering me a course with teacher Andrew Olinsky titled Going Forth. My favorite type of book is a memoir, so I was thrilled to receive a book from Mae Sarton. And I'm extremely interested in the process of life and how others manage their way through it. I'm not nearly as interested as the lesson someone learned as I am the process they took to learn those lessons. And since Mae was sharing her journal of a year so similar to what I desired, I found the book to kick off my 1 year of solitude. Andrew's course is an 8-week course, and it's still available, although of course it's no longer live. The course offers everything I was looking for to guide me on my sabbatical. Andrew teaches the suttas, something I wanted more of. He provides commentary on what the suttas meant in the day of the Buddha and how we might interpret that meaning in modern life. He offers practical guidance on how we might experience the act of going forth in our own lives and, at the time, offered space for discussion groups. I don't mean to market the course, but if you're interested in the topic of going forth, I highly recommend it. So I'll share some discourses, but I'll just be giving you the discourse and the number. And if you want me to tell you afterwards what they were, I'll give that to you, but it's something that you can easily look up. Andrew began the course by reviewing Discourse 27 from the middle length discourses. So these are the scriptures, the text of the Buddha, and this is called the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle discourses. So in 27, here the Buddha encourages us to go forth, basically to leave our lives as householders, someone who pays the bills, raises a family, keeps life going for everybody, and to become homeless. To live a wanderer's life dedicated to the experience of the Dhamma. So this way of life is a bit unrealistic for most of us. It's not something our culture encourages or even supports, although I know many people who have found their version of going forth, those who have hiked the Appalachian Trail or the Camino with nothing but the clothes on their back. Maybe some teach in English as a second language in countries outside the U.S., and even going on a year sabbatical in their own home. So here I'd like to talk a little bit about the suttas, the Pali Canon or Buddhist scriptures. I've always been intimidated by them, and I find them hard to read. I don't like to read Shakespeare either. I don't like the redundancy of writing in the suttas. But once I learned that the redundancy had a purpose, I was more able to open up to them. I mean, I can read Jack or Joseph's interpretations, or I can read translations by noted scholars like Bhikkhu Bodhi and develop my own interpretation. This isn't to deny the benefit of teachers. I love reading those guys, and Sharon and Tara. They all have so much to offer. But when I gave up the intimidation and began to read the discourses on my own, my level of understanding really did go deeper. I had to learn how to skim the redundancy and not be annoyed with it, and how to consider practically word for word the meaning of each lesson. If, like me, you have some challenge reading the text or believing that what you're reading is actually true, then I offer this. During the time of the Buddha, oral communication was much more valued than writing. We've all probably played the telephone game, where I whisper something in your ear and you whisper it to the next person and the next person, and finally the last person stands up and says something totally unrelated that has nothing to do with what I first said. So we've developed skills through evolution that we value the most, and accurate verbal communication is not necessarily one of those skills. We've learned to depend on the written word. So the repetition we find in the Pali Canon was intentional to ensure consistency and accuracy of what was taught and what continues to be taught. You might be interested in an article titled "The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Text." I don't know the authors, but you can Google it. And it really helps to understand what it is that we're reading. And if you go on Amazon, you can find the discourses as translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. While he himself is a scholar, his writings and teachings are very accessible to us common folk. Many of us here tonight had the honor of being in retreat with him just a couple of weeks ago, and he took us through an entire sutta exploring its context from the time of the Buddha and in our modern times. And it's so important to understand that the ancient scriptures of any religion or belief were developed for that specific time and for that specific culture. So when we take things literally that were written thousands of years ago, that's a great door to extremism and manifesting that unyielding flexibility that we need when we try to understand what someone told us 2,500 years ago, 2,600 years ago. And I'd also like to share some thoughts on solitude. For me and many of you, solitude is easy. Many of you know Nancy. She's here at the Sangha, and she has a t-shirt that says something like, "I don't want to go outside, it's too people-y out there." And I can totally relate to that. But for others, solitude is a bit more challenging. Less is more. My intention was and is to live a life with more solitude, allowing deeper contemplation and reflection. And this meant disengaging from most social and service obligations. I made the determination of what I felt would serve that desire and what wouldn't. When I walk with the same friends every day or most days, I tend to talk out loud about things that I haven't really processed. I'm processing out loud, which really isn't a natural strength of mine. So I needed to disengage from those activities where I was with friends who I felt so comfortable with that I was telling them all of what was going on in my mind, and receiving, at times, their projections and their judgments. And I was also giving them my projections and my judgments. I tend to take on the projection and judgments of others. So that was something that I needed to see clearly and to really understand and be with. So I didn't feel the need to completely disengage, but rather choose my walking partners and visits discriminately. I found most of my friends extremely supportive. Again, the joy of being in a sangha. We might see one another less often, or when we do see each other for a walk, maybe we don't talk as much. We just respect the solitude and the quiet. For those who couldn't support me, I made a conscious decision to let go. And this has been scary because there's a part of me that's afraid they might let go. So now I'm facing the abandonment patterns of life and looking at that fear. Without a therapist or a teacher or a good friend, can I turn towards those fears in a healthy way and be with them? There's a beautiful poem by Rumi that goes, "This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." So here Rumi is talking about what Buddhists refer to as Mara, basically a demon who tempts us, a metaphor for dark thoughts and our shadow side. I love the many stories about Mara. In Jack's book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, he says, "The Buddha regards Mara not just as a guest, but as a friend. Oh, my old friend has come," says the Buddha, as he warmly greets Mara, inviting him in for tea. So solitude gives us the space to invite Mara in for tea, without the worldly distractions of TV, radio, internet, and yes, even conversation. We find ourselves alone with our thoughts. And if we're committed to the practice, we can skillfully be with those thoughts, turning toward rather than away, and finding our deepest truths rather than accepting the projections and judgments of others. Please know that I'm not telling you that therapists, teachers, and friends aren't important or helpful. Far from that. Had I not had that support system early in life, I don't even want to think about where my life would be right now. But having done all that work and having the resources that are available to us now and having faith in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, I can trust that when Mara visits, there's something for me to learn, and that as surely as Mara visits, Mara leaves. It'll subside, or maybe it will even go away. I also want to make very clear that I'm not talking about clinical depression, where I've experienced and found that to be the embodiment of Mara, having no ability to rationally experience my pain and suffering without help. So in Andrew's course, he shared that the entire science of Buddhist psychology is a way of understanding our inner life. Buddha taught us to hear the teachings, learn the teachings, remember the teachings, investigate the teachings for ourselves, and put the teachings into practice. In the Middle Discourse 82, we learn the typical reasons why one might go forth. We might experience great loss or tragedy, reach a stage in life when it just feels like it's time to go forth, to be more spiritual. Or find ourselves a slave of desire, and we constantly or consciously choose to break free. For me, it was a bit of all those reasons, but mainly I wanted to step out of the conventional world and live in a more existential state. I want to sit out on the deck and contemplate sickness and death and loss, what I've experienced and what I might experience. I want to watch CNN and look on Facebook to observe how I feel when faced with current politics and the health of our culture, economy, and Mother Earth. I'm not disengaging with the world, I'm merely changing the way that I engage. In the Middle Discourse 39, the Buddha laid out seven qualities of going forth. commitment to intentional practice, conducting oneself with self-respect and respect of others, purifying the mind, guarding the sense doors, being moderate in eating, being devoted to wakefulness, and being possessed of mindfulness. These qualities might be seen as just living the practice, and one might ask, well, what's the difference in just a daily practice and going forth? And my only response is that in going forth, we intentionally set up a discipline or structure that supports these qualities a bit beyond a daily intention of practice. Each of us has probably made some commitment to intentional practice. I've meditated for years, sometimes a lot, sometimes not so much. For me, in going forth, I've extended this quality to mean meditation and study. So I've attended several retreats since I began my sabbatical, and I've put forth more effort to attend talks from various teachers. I subscribe now to Audible on Amazon, so I can read or listen to books while I drive or I walk. I love reading, and I'm a slow reader, so the Audible app helps me. It also motivates me to walk alone. I love walking and hearing nature. I also love that I can walk for an hour or more while I listen to a good book. This is my commitment to intentional practice. I've spent many hours contemplating respect for myself and others. Recently, I've managed to spend time with several people I truly love and who are very conservative. A friend of mine, I worked with her in the Department of Defense. She came for a short visit a couple weeks ago. And then last week, I spent the whole time in Georgia. And many of those people are Trump supporters, which I'm not. It would be quite easy to call them all idiots and have pity on them for their ignorance, as they may feel for me. But is that respectful? I recognize that we have differences, and honestly, I've learned to have more compassion than judgment for those people who get caught up in the fear machine of Fox News and radical right radio. And by experiencing my own fear that our country's going straight to hell, I'm able to understand and have compassion for their fear. I may not understand what they're afraid of, but through love and respect for these people and experience with my own possibly irrational fears, I'm able to let go of my need for them to think just like me, and I can relate to feeling fearful. Honestly, these aren't people I want to spend all my time with. Of course I enjoy being with like-minded individuals, but my heart is capable of holding space and visits with those who think differently than me. In fact, it's respect for myself that I open my mind to the possibility that not every single thing they say or believe is wrong. And out of respect for one another, we've learned how to focus on our sameness, our oneness, rather than our differences. All of that said, it's really important to purify the mind, to stay away from unwholesome experiences and people. I found myself in toxic relationships with people I consider liberal, and in very loving relationships with those who are very conservative. Is it possible that the mind's need to categorize and label and experience a world of duality is actually toxic to our happiness? Guarding the sense doors is one way in which we might purify the mind. The sense doors are those that allow information into the brain, hearing, seeing, smelling, feeling, even thoughts are sense door. So I enjoy watching TV. And some people have a lot of judgment around that statement. Some believe it's fine to watch Masterpiece Theater. But if you're watching a reality show, you've got problems. And it's true that paying attention to what we watch on television or listen to on the radio and how much time we spend in those activities is critical to a calm and peaceful mind. We can become addicted to the distractions that we take in. Several weeks ago, I was out at Heartwood Refuge, And one teacher mentioned watching a Dharma show on television with Panawati, and Panawati just kind of gave her a little embarrassing laugh like she does. And of course, we all wanted to know, what was this Dharma show on TV that she was watching? It turned out to be the very dark and demented political drama Scandal. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I loved that she said that. Because I love watching TV shows and movies and live theater through the Dhamma. What makes that person tick? What choice did that person make that sent them to another choice, that sent them down a rabbit hole or maybe back up? It's fascinating to watch character development in good storytelling. But I can't watch horror films. The content just gets stuck in my psyche and I have nightmares. And when I'm doing, you know, some deep work, it can really mess with my mind. So I kind of have to guard that sense door by just not watching them. And I can pick and choose what I can watch and be okay with and what I can't. I was really happy when I did this course and found that one of the qualities of going forth was to be moderate in eating. You know that Buddha. He just knew it. So one of my reasons for sabbatical was to finally understand my relationship with food. I'd given up alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, spending money I don't have, sexual promiscuity. But the same drivers that manifested all those unskillful behaviors that I've been able to let go of serve my relationship with food. And I know how to deny myself to lose weight, only to gain it back. But what if eating was something I did to nurture and support a healthy body rather than how I deal with emotions or how I make myself skinny enough to be loved and to be wanted? A resource I want to share with you all is a book titled The Mindful Diet. It's written by doctors who work in the Duke Integrative Medicine Program, and I swore I would never buy another diet book. I don't like that the title of the book has diet in it. But it's helping me put mindfulness into practice. And isn't that what our meditation is for? Learning mindfulness so we can take it off the cushion and go off into the real world. The last two qualities of going forth are being devoted to wakefulness and being possessed of mindfulness. And like all of us, the Buddha was a seeker. He was a human being who wanted to be happy. The word Buddha means the awakened one, or to be awake. He tried various spiritual paths available at the time, and he finally realized that none of those paths could deliver him to liberation, freedom from pain and suffering. So he finally went out on his own, and when he woke up, he shared his experience with us. We are all capable of waking up. But maybe enlightenment is a little too lofty a goal right now. Maybe we're able to get intellectually that we're capable of our own enlightenment, but it doesn't really feel real to us. It isn't easy to become enlightened on the way to pick up the kids from school. So what if we just practice mindfulness and trust that enlightenment is possible but not a required goal? Think of it like yoga, where our goal isn't a perfectly posed asana, but rather meeting our body where it is today, right now, in this present moment. When Andrew spoke of mindfulness, he said, the content of what is happening in our mind isn't important. The process of what is happening is important. And are we completely lost in thought, or are we mindful of our thoughts and feelings? So again, it's about process, not content. Many of us use a resource called the Insight Timer. It's on a smartphone, and you can use it for meditation. I've set up a preset and titled it Walking. And I've set it for an hour, and every 10 minutes I have a bell that goes off. So if I decide that I'm taking a mindfulness walk rather than a reading walk, I can set that. And every 10 minutes while I'm walking through these beautiful woods, a little bell will go off that reminds me, where am I? Because sometimes I'm not on that beautiful path. Sometimes I'm at home with the dog. Sometimes I'm in the car driving somewhere, you know, just like we are all the time. So just giving myself that timer, that every 10-minute tiny little ding says, oh, I'll be present now. I've shared that going forth is a bit more, even symbolically speaking, than our daily mindfulness and meditation practice. I've touched on what I learned in the Going Forth course. There's so much more. I've learned so much in this first 6 months, and now I'm taking the opportunity to consider what I might want for the next 6 months. Can I deepen my commitment even further? Am I willing to spend even more time in solitude? Can I spend less time in passive engagement, less TV, Facebook, radio? Is this how I'd like to spend the remainder of my life? I'm definitely realizing that solitude suits me. My relationships are actually stronger than they've ever been, and my connection to nature is stronger, and my relationship to myself is stronger. Maybe I'll take the opportunities to spend more time in silent retreat. I don't need to go away for retreat. I can do that at home. I've done that at home. It's nice to go on retreat and have that mega boost where someone's taking care of us, ringing the bell for us, fixing our meals for us. We don't have to think. But when that's not available, it doesn't mean that we can't take care of ourselves. One thing I've done to support the next 6 months is resign from our leadership team. So this is my last talk at AIM, at least for now. And I'm humbly and deeply grateful to Rania for giving me the opportunity, and to all of you for your constant support and encouragement. Some of you I see often and some not so much, but I always know that the AIM Sangha is here. My professional role before retirement was that of facilitator, to make things easy for others. And I've always seen my talks as an opportunity to possibly make the Dhamma, the work that we do, a little easier by sharing that no matter who we are, it's hard work. Don't be discouraged. Give yourself a break. When you need it, give yourself a break and don't beat yourself up. Most of all, just be kind to yourself. So as I've done with every talk that I've given at AIM, I like to end with these words of the Buddha. Believe nothing just because a so-called wise person said it. Believe nothing just because a belief is generally held. Believe nothing just because it's said in ancient books. Believe nothing just because it's said to be of divine origin. Believe nothing just because someone else believes it. Believe only what you yourself test and judge to be true. And I hope that tonight maybe I inspired you to look into going forth, however that might fit into your life, a day, a week, a month, a year. But just know that it's there for you. Thank you.